I wish to speak to you about on some things this morning that are of interest to all of us, regardless of your religious affiliation or whether or not you have a religious affiliation. If we are nothing, and we came from nothing, and we're headed for nothing, we might as well obey the slick beer ad, you only sail around once, do so with gusto. On the other hand, if we came from something, and we are something, and something made us, then we need to find out something about the one that made us and his laws and requirements. If I were to tell you, intelligent young people, this morning, that a frog turned into a prince just like that, what would you call that? You'd call it a fairy tale. But on the other hand, if I were to tell you that a frog turned into a prince over 300 million years, that's science. You see, the only difference between a frog turning into a prince like that being a fairy tale and a frog turning into a prince over 300 million years, is the time element involved. As I stand before you this morning, I want to make one little clarification. I don't say this in criticism of your radio station or the way this was introduced, but the introduction I heard twice over the radio station this morning was that I would speak this morning on creation versus the theory of evolution. Now, that's not exactly fair, because science is based on observation. And I cannot walk outside today and point my finger on creation taking place because it's finished work. On the other hand, an evolutionist cannot walk outside this morning and put his finger on evolution taking place because he says it took place slowly over a period of time. Since we do not see creation before our eyes, and since we do not see evolution before our eyes, then from one standpoint, they're both a theory, from a standpoint of reasoning and logic, since we don't see it. However, I'm not going to refer to creation as a theory this morning, or refer to evolution as a theory. I'm going to refer to these things as models, a creation model and an evolution model, and let us put both models before us so that we can study them. You might ask the question, well, are you against evolution? That depends on what you mean by evolution. I've studied several schools of evolution. Number one is evolution chance, Darwinian evolution. Evolution by natural selection, which other evolutionists have denied. Then there is theistic evolution, progressive evolution. And before I get through this morning, if I don't forget it, I want to speak on a new field of evolution, which is known as recapitulation or reverse evolution. When you say, are you against evolution, you'll have to define evolution. Because as far as evolution from a standpoint of maintaining creation, that has its origin in creation. I don't object to that because I can work in evolution from a standpoint of maintenance, of maintaining something that's already originated and been created. The objections we have are to evolution to attempt to explain origin. Now then, I want to drop this right quickly. Evolution, someone says, well, now, wait a minute, creation is religion and evolution is science. Well, my friends, evolution can become religion. I'm not going to get into it at the auditorium this morning, but the Lord willing, I'll probably get into it at the church before I leave this week. But there were parents that objected and wanted to fire the young man Scopes in 1925 in Tennessee for teaching evolution in the Tennessee schools when they were paying preachers a salary to teach spiritual evolution in their churches. Now, if you want to know what spiritual evolution is, you'll have to hear me in a church house, not in an auditorium. Evolution, when it's carried too far, can become a religion. Karl Marx says that Darwin's theories were the basis of his communist philosophy. And I want to say this morning. The statements that I'm going to read to you and going to quote to you, I have the books in a rack behind you, dozens of them, not by preachers, but by some of the most outstanding scientists that this world has ever known. Those statements are here. I can verify and put my finger on the page, the chapter, and every statement I make this morning, I can back it and verify it. First of all, to say that Marx derived his ideas from Darwin. I quote directly, Orthodox Marxian socialists in the early years of the 20th century felt quite at home in Darwinian surroundings. Reading The Origin of Species in 1860, he reported to Frederick Engels and later declared to Ferdinand Lassalle that Darwin's book is very important and serves me as a basis of natural science for the class struggle in history. On the shelves of the socialist bookstores in Germany, the works of Darwin and Marx stood side by side. He read Darwin's theory, which taught the survival of the fittest, that living things were in a struggle against each other and the fittest survived. This gave Marx his idea for the struggle of the classes, which became the foundation of communism. All right, Adolf Hitler was also a Darwinian evolutionist because he justified the murder of the Jews and people he considered inferior races because he said that they were the missing links in the evolutionary chain. Now, my friends, this morning, one notion I want to dispel right quickly is this. Somebody says, well, all scientists are evolutionists. That's not so. The Bible Science Association, the Creation Science Research Center, which has a voting membership at the present time of over 575 top scientists. To have voting rights in the association, one must have a PhD or a master's degree in some particular field of science. Now, ministers, you teachers with a BA, you students out there, can belong to the Bible Science Association. It has thousands of members. We put out a monthly 5 minutes with the Bible and Science and a monthly Bible Science newsletter. There are thousands of scientists who believe in the Genesis account of creation. Some of them are at NASA. Some of them are the deans of schools. They have put out an outstanding set of creationist textbooks. We have tapes and film strips available. And our men have debated on public platforms, men with the opposing views, debates such as this, by friends such as mine, such as Dr. Mulfinger, Dr. Dwayne Gish, Dr. Emmett Williams, Dr. Henry Morris, have been held in some of the largest universities in America. One of the first things that I want to establish today is that science, as we have already said, is based on what we can observe. And we're told in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 6, that there would come a time of the last days when there would arise scoffers walking after their own lust, and that these scoffers would teach that all things continue as they were from the creation of the world. Peter goes on to say that this they willingly are ignorant of. They are willfully ignorant of the fact that the world before the flood, being overflowed with water, perished. But he says, but the heavens which are now, they're reserved unto fire. Peter says there will come a time when men will teach the scientific doctrine of uniformitarianism, that all things continue as they were, that everything on earth can be measured. It is decaying just like it always has. But he says they're ignorant of the fact that there was a world, the other side of the flood, where the decay and atmospheric conditions that prevail today did not exist then. There are two major fields of geology. One is uniformitarianism. Uniformitarianism teaches that things decay and can be measured at a fairly uniform or constant rate, sedimentation, burial, etc. On the other hand, there is flood geology, which teaches that in times past, there have been a number of catastrophes on Earth. Volcanic eruptions, the splitting of continents, the great Genesis flood, which could accomplish in a few thousands of years what sedimentation and uniformitarianism would require millions of years to produce. I have a little poem I give to young people all across the country, and the little poem goes this way. I once was a tadpole long and thin, then I was a froggy with my tail tucked in. Then I was a monkey in a banyan tree, and now at last I'm a doctor with a PhD. Tadpole, froggy, and monkey man, all glory to nothing for the planless plan. But I'm not suggesting this morning that we ban the teaching of evolution in the public schools. I'm not asking that. I'm not asking that at all. But in the state of California and the state of Tennessee, those who believe in scientific creationism have had enough influence that they are teaching the creation model alongside the evolution model, and the student can decide which one they want. And that's all we're asking, is that we get a hearing. The Bible tells us in Proverbs 18:13 that he that answereth the matter before he heareth it, it's a shame and folly to him. I don't ask that the theory of evolution be pushed out the door. And by the way, you're going to have to define what you mean by evolution. All we want is a hearing to be able to present the side that there is a far better scientific argument for creationism than anything that man has ever produced. Right here we have a chart of the present world with the continents. Surrounding this earth is an ozone shield. You hear a lot of fuss about this today because of the freon that's allegedly going into the atmosphere, the spray cans and all of that, and the damage that they think might be done to the ozone shield and damage life here on earth. The ozone shield and the magnetic shield, these two shields still exist. There are a number of reputable scientists in the world today that believe in the world before the flood that there was a third shield, which was a vapor shield, a vapor or water that surrounded the earth. These shields are possible because Venus has one today. Venus has this vapor canopy. I don't have time to get into it this morning, but this vapor canopy is taught in the Bible. There's more and more scientific evidence since the days of NASA and the space probes that the earth at one time had a third shield. Of course, you know, if these two shields were taken away, we could not live on earth as we do today. The effects of this magnetic shield that was around that world before the flood, first of all, it would cause a greenhouse effect on the entire earth. The entire earth would be like a greenhouse. The earth would have been held at an even temperature all over. There would have been a longer lifespan because the cosmic rays, the radiation coming from the sun, would have been filtered out by the magnetic shield. Some evidences that the earth at one time was a beautiful greenhouse that had vegetation all over it is that up here at the North Pole in the frozen waste have been found the bodies of thousands of mammoths. Some of these mammoths are standing perfectly upright, frozen in silt. They have buttercups on their mouths. They have vegetation in buttercups on their lips, vegetation in their mouths, and undigested vegetation in their bellies. When these mammoths are thawed out, the meat has been cooked and been found fairly good to eat. Now that teaches us something about that mammoth. Whatever it was that destroyed him just like that. It froze him. And since the mammoth froze, he's not had the time to thaw out, or else his meat would have spoiled. Charles Darwin knew about these mammoths and said that he had no solution to it, that he could not reconcile those mammoths to his particular theories at that particular time. Lyell, or Lyell as he's called in England, the man that drew up the geologic column that we're going to get to in a minute, Lyell made up a little explanation that maybe these mammoths were swimming in water and the water suddenly froze. Question, what has kept it frozen? And in the next place, what caused the water to freeze? These mammoths at the North Pole fed on amounts of vegetation that's not present there today. Next, in the deserts and down at the South Pole, we find evidences of vegetation. In the Gobi Desert, we find over there the eggs of dinosaurs that required a tremendous amount of vegetation to live on. There's abundant evidence that the earth at one time was a beautiful paradise all over, that it produced lush vegetation at the poles and the deserts today. Another effect that this vapor shield would have had is that some of the dating methods that are used today to date the rocks, to date the fossils, such as carbon-14, uranium to lead, potassium to argon, that these things which could apply in the present-day world might not apply over here as they applied in our present world for this reason. Carbon-14 is formed by cosmic rays from the sun striking our atmosphere, and I won't get bogged down in this. I'll just vastly oversimplify it. If somebody wants to talk about it later, I'll give you 4 or 5 hours. But carbon-14 is being formed in our atmosphere at the present time at rates at which can be measured. You have carbon-14 in your body. I have it in mine. Living things have it. And when a living thing dies, for instance, that carbon-14 begins to dissipate in half-life, which can be measured. But this vapor shield would have had the effect of filtering out the carbon-14 so that a man or animal that lived in the world before the flood, before that vapor shield collapsed, that if we found his bones today by carbon-14, they would contain none or practically none and would date millions of years old, even though they might only be a few thousand years old. Dr. Melvin Cook, who is the leading man in the field of carbon-14, measured the carbon-14 in the rate in the Earth's atmosphere at rates which are established today. And he established that if we started at point zero with a brand new atmosphere, at rates at which carbon-14 is now being formed, that the atmosphere of the universe, or the atmosphere of the Earth, excuse me, should be uniform and stable in its content of carbon-14 in 30,000 years. It's only two-thirds stabilized today, indicating that our atmosphere is 20,000 years old or less. All right, when this information came out, and I want to say this to you right now, Daniel warns us in Daniel 12:4. He says one of the signs of the latter days would be that many would run to and fro and knowledge would become increased. The amount of knowledge available in any field is doubling every 5 years. A PhD friend of mine in California, a biochemist, went back for some research study and found that nearly everything had changed since he was in school. A famous scientist made the statement a few months back. He said that, I still believe that light, that the fastest thing on earth is the speed of light, maybe. And there are a lot of dogmatic statements that were in the textbooks when I was in school that the space probe and information that's coming to light has disproved. All right, Melvin Cook, when he came out with this information, the atheists set up a howl. They said, we know the Earth has got to be older than that. Yet your tests prove that it's probably 20,000 years old or less. They said that at one time there was a vapor shield around the earth that filtered out the carbon-14 and didn't allow it to enter. So the atheists were forced into the same identical thing that the Bible teaches to avoid Melvin Cook's findings. All right? We find here the inconsistencies of those dating methods. When you take carbon-14, potassium to argon, and uranium to lead, sometimes we can date something by one method and get a date of thousands of years, date it by another method, and you'll get dates of millions of years. For instance, over in Africa, when Leakey dug up Zenzanthropus, and I'll get to him in a minute, he tested him by potassium to argon, said 1.75 million years old. On the other hand, Zenzanthropus was tested by carbon-14 at 10,000 years old. Dr. Robert E. Lee Whitelaw of Virginia Poly in Blacksburg, Virginia, tested it at less than 7,000. All right, notice that. One test says 1.75 million. Another says 10,000. Well, you see, I mean, what's 1.75 million years one way or the other? You know, science is exact, you know. I mean, one test, 1.75 million, one 10,000, another 7,000. That sounds like exact science to me. All right. In 1970, a living mollusk, one that was alive at the time, was tested by carbon-14 and proved to be dead for 3,000 years. Coal, which has been on Earth long enough to have had the carbon-14 leached out, is loaded with it. Coal contains carbon-14 even when found on the surface. In 1801, a volcano exploded in the Hawaiian Islands. The lava that came out of it formed into rocks. These rocks were dated, and they were dated in 1971, 170 years later. They were dated at 230 million years old, even though historically we could prove that they were only 170 years old. Somebody's pulling your leg. All right? Somebody says, what about the moon rocks, preacher man? Well, there was an article in the U.S. News and World Report lately. The title of it was, Whatever Became of the Moon Rocks? You haven't heard much about the moon rocks lately, have you? The reason you haven't heard much about the moon rocks is the moon rocks didn't prove what they were supposed to prove. Those moon rocks tested by one method would test billions of years old. Tested by another method, they'd test zero. Next, if you watch that moon shot on TV, when that fella came out of that spaceship, he came out stepping real gingerly like this, you know, going to take that great step for mankind. And then if you remember, he walks out there with that American flag and starts having trouble with it. He's flopped over and he has a heap of trouble. The reason he had a heap of trouble is that there's a dust in the atmosphere, meteorite dust, different types of dust, that's settling on this earth, and if this earth didn't have an atmosphere to absorb it, and if this earth is millions of years old, it ought to be about 54 feet deep. And since the moon doesn't have an atmosphere, they expected that dust on the moon to be perhaps a few feet thick, and they had fixed that American flag to go out here and set it in a dust dune, or better, a sand dune or a dust dune. And when that guy stepped out of that capsule, he stepped in dust that was just a few inches thick. And he went over there and he had to drive that flag, not in a dust dune, but in rock. And the measurement of the dust indicated the moon to probably be about 6,000 years old. That's why you haven't heard much about the moon rocks lately. All right. In 1963, right off the island of Iceland, there was a volcanic explosion. I've got a picture of it in the National Geographic right under here. An island was formed. Here's a picture in 1963 of a rugged, jagged island. The geologists studied that thing, and they said those rugged, jagged rocks, over a long period of years, should wear down smooth, form sandy beaches, and vegetable life, plant life, should start forming. To their surprise, I have the pictures to where those rocks were worn smooth and those beaches appeared and plant life appeared within a matter of weeks, not years, weeks. The geologists were dumbfounded. There are some ways that have been used to measure up to this day and time that just won't cut the mustard anymore. All right, in Genesis chapter 10, verse 25, we learn another fact. Genesis chapter 10, verse 25, and I started preaching this 10 years ago because I found it in the Word of God. Genesis 10:25 says there was a man named Eber that had two sons. The name of one was Peleg, Hebrew word for division, because in his days was the earth divided. He was named Peleg because the earth divided in his days. I read that in the Bible. In the National Geographic magazine, I've got it right here, January 1973. We have there where the ablest geologists on earth agree that this earth at one time was one mass of land and one mass of water, and it split into continents over a period of years. Because you see, you remove the Atlantic Ocean, and I drew that, and I'm not much of an artist, but if you remove the Atlantic Ocean, the pieces of this coast and that coast would slide together like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. I have before under there reports of where the rock layer samples were taken in Africa and Brazil. They're exactly the same. Not only that, your pyramid civilizations in Africa were right about here. Your Maya, Aztec, and Inca civilizations were right about here. Put it back together, you've got a great pyramid civilization right about there. All right, notice. Somebody says, how'd the American Indian get over here? I heard all that business about a raft, you know, and he came down here and finally wound up down there. I'll give you another explanation. The earth was one great mass of land. And in the world the other side of the flood, God split it. And the Indian wound up over here, trapped or better off, whichever way you want to look at it. All right? Layer samples in Brazil and Africa. Pyramid civilizations at the same latitude. Give me a little hand, son. I appreciate you boys being up here. I'd get better attention if I had a couple of pretty girls. Right, whoa. All right, listen carefully. This stuff is brand new, and it's causing a howl in the scientific world right now. And I mean all kinds of folks that say they never heard of it, but I've got it all stacked right under here. I mean, this is the biggie. Dr. Thomas G. Barnes with the University of Texas at El Paso, the president of the Creation Science Research Society, professor of physics, one of the leading men in electronics and physics, that's written several textbooks that are standard textbooks used in schools all over America, a leader in atmospheric physics, was doing a research project for the government. In doing this research project for the government, he was supposed to study the decay of the Earth's magnetic field, that is, the decay of its moment. The Earth's magnetic field has been measured worldwide accurately for over 135 years. Now, I want you young people to notice something. I'm not up here this morning to quarrel with science teachers. The most ridiculous statements I've ever heard in my life weren't made by science teachers. They were made by preachers that didn't know what they were talking about, and they were made by philosophy and history teachers. Dr. Wayne Faircloth, Ph.D., professor at Valdosta, Georgia, a dear friend of mine, a man who is one of the leading men in botany and biology, heard me speak on this subject one time and left that seminar and left that meeting and went to Boulder, Colorado to lecture to a nationwide gathering of botanists and biologists. He knows what he's talking about. Dr. Faircloth told me, he said, most of the wild, ridiculous theories that you hear taught are not taught in science classes. They're taught in history and philosophy classes. You probably got some very fine science teachers here. No applause, please. I'm not opposed to them. Some of the finest friends I have on this earth are science teachers. But my friends, there is a mass of information that's flooding in every field today. And just because a man hasn't heard of something doesn't mean he's ignorant. It just means that he hasn't got down here to the bottom of about a 4-foot stack of books and information that hits most any teacher's desk. I could leave home for a week and my desk rounds over like that. I'd have to read all the time to read all the information that people send me from one place to the next. All right. The Earth's magnetic field, he found, is decaying in rates that can be measured and have been measured for 135 years. It's decaying in half-lives of 1,400 years, which put in another way, says this. That working backward, measuring this decay, if it's decaying in half-lives of 1,400 years, going back 1,400 years, it would have been twice as strong as it is now. Then four times, eight times. All right? Here we are now. Here, watch this curve. A.D. 500, 1,400 years ago, twice as strong. B.C. 900, four times as strong. Here comes the flood. 2,300 B.C., eight times as strong. 3,700 B.C., 16 times as strong. 5,100 B.C., 32 times as strong. An Earth with a magnetic field 32 times as strong as it is now would be as strong as a magnetic star. It would be glowing hot. Magnetic stars have nuclear reactions. In other words, you couldn't live here. The decay of the Earth's magnetic field establishes that working backward, this Earth cannot be over 7 to 8,000 years B.C. All right, add 2,000 over here, 7 to 8 over here. You've got a maximum age of the Earth of about 9 to 10,000 years. This explains why the Carthaginians, they traveled the seas of the Earth with compasses, which won't work for us today, but they work for them. And the reason those compasses work for them is because they were living in a earth that had a stronger magnetic field. All right, watch this. Working backward, the life tolerance at which man could probably live here on earth comfortably would have been about the time of the flood. And I told you we had a different world before the flood. The Bible says the world before the flood was a different world, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished, but the heavens and the earth which are now. You can't prove things in the world before the flood by looking at the world in which we're living now. God's Bible says it was a different world. Here's one more proof of it. All right. Here are some statistics on human multiplication. Now, to work this out on an algebra equation, I can work it out for you. It would take an algebra equation that just about covers this piece of paper. And there's nothing will put people asleep in an auditorium any quicker than algebra. In fact, there's nothing will put you to sleep any faster in an algebra class than algebra. Amen. All right. But here are the results. Here are the results of the equation. All right. Going back 4,300 years ago, the approximate time of the flood, according to Usher's Bible chronology, and if I had a little time, I could prove to you that everything that's coming up is justifying what that old, good old Episcopalian taught. They used to laugh at him, but they're not laughing at him much anymore. I go back 4,300 years ago, the approximate time of the flood, I take eight people, and just establishing that these eight people lived the average of 35 years each and had four children, I could arrive at the present population of the earth in 1,050 years. It doesn't take folks long to multiply. All right, going back 4,300 years, 35 years per person, three children, we could have the present population of the earth in only 1,820 years. If I went back 4,300 years, persons lived 43 years and had 2.5 children. I don't know how you have a half child. But you can come out... Well, I can think of a way. You come out here with the present population of the earth in 4,300 years. In other words, follow this carefully. The present growth rate of the earth is 2% per year now. Somebody says, well, preacher, wait a minute. What about superior medicine today? People live longer. I'd like to talk to you about that sometime. People that get past 15 years of age live long. If you get past 15 years of age, you're not going to live any longer than people did a long time ago. Most of them died in infancy, in, childhood diseases. But that's another field. All right. The present growth rate of the earth is 2% growth rate a year now. This formula that I've used is only 0.5% growth rate a year. In other words, I could take a formula and allow people to multiply 1/4 as fast as they are now. That ought to allow for wars, disasters. The bloodiest war has been fought in history, been fought in the last 100 years. All right? Now then, we can arrive at the population of the earth in 4,300 years. And that's about the date that we ordinarily assign to the flood, taking eight people, we come out with the present population of the earth. All right. I was taught in school that man had been on earth about 1 million years. Taking this same growth rate, 0.5%, that we ordinarily assign to the flood, taking eight people, we come out with the present population of the earth. All right. I was taught in school that man had been on earth about 1 million years. Taking this same growth rate, 0.5%, there should be enough people on earth right now, a number equal to 10 raised to the 2,155th power, which is 1 with 2,155 zeros. If you'd like to know how big that number is, according to Einstein's estimate of the size of the universe and according to the estimate of the size of an electron, the number of electrons that would fit into our universe if you crammed it with electrons would be anywhere from 10 raised to the 80th power to 10 raised to the 130th power, which is 1 with anywhere from 80 to 130 zeros. This number here is so great that if man has been on earth 1 million years, multiplying at the rate of 0.5% a year, there should be enough people on earth to fill every cubic foot of the universe to the best estimate of the universe's size. If so, where are their fossils? There should be an abundance of human fossils, like sea fossils, but only a few doubtful fragments exist. Could it be, dust thou art and dost thou return it? Your chance of becoming a fossil are very poor. Sedimentation forms slowly. Fossils have got to be covered rapidly. At one time, there were millions of buffalo over the American plains. They didn't fossilize. The predators and the weather destroyed their bodies and bones. Sea fishes don't die and go to the bottom of the sea and fossilize. They're usually eaten by predators.
men that have drilled for oil have been surprised at how little sediment that there is at the bottom of the sea. All right. Now then, right here, right quick. All right. Now then, we come to the geologic column. Here's the geologic column. Now, these dates will vary according to a few million years, according to which column you look at. Scientists don't even agree themselves. Here's the geologic column. You say, oh, I suppose they established that by modern dating methods. No, sir. This little baby was drawn up way, way back yonder before carbon-14, potassium to argon, uranium to lead, or modern dating methods were ever thought of. This thing was drawn up a long time ago. It's got some great big words on it. And I want to say this right quickly. One of the main things that parents pay for to send their kids to college is so that their kids can learn to say things like Cambrian and Ordovician and Silurian, Devonian, Mississippian, Permian, Mesozoic, Cenozoic, Paleozoic, and so they can say things like Australopithecus, Pleopithecus, Homeopithecus erectus, Homo habilis. All right, for instance, Homo habilis means handyman. Australopithecus means southern ape. Southern ape. Ramapithecus, Rama was a Hindu god. Pithecus means ape. That means god ape. But you see, my boy is going down here to Texas Tech. And if he's to come home saying handyman, upright man, southern ape, I wouldn't think I was getting my money's worth. But if he can come in home saying Australopithecus, Zenzanthropus, Homeopithecus, Cenozoic, Paleozoic, Paleolithic, dad's getting his money's worth. That's what it's all about. All right. All right. Now then. All right. This column that you're looking at, by the way, these words all have simple meanings. This means kind of, late or recent. That means middle. That means real old. Somebody says, why didn't they say middle, recent, and old? Again, if you bring a kid into a college freshman class and you say, that's a pile of bones, it doesn't impress him much. But if you get up there and say, that's the bones of a Hesperopithecus, he says, gee, a guy that can say words like that has got to be smart. He's a god, a priest, and bound to. There ain't no way Professor Spellfungus could be wrong. All right? Now then. All right? This column that we're looking at is easy to draw. It's easy to draw. I can teach you how to draw that thing in about 30 minutes. That thing is easy to draw, but it's hard to prove in the world of reality. The kids are taught is that this layer formed first with the fossils, then this one, then this one, then this one, then this one. And you ought to be able to go out here and drill an oil well or drill down in the earth, and you'll find her just like that. But when you get out in the world of reality, sometimes you find these old rocks and old fossils on the top. Sometimes you find the new ones in the middle. Sometimes you find the new ones on the bottom. They're jumbled up every which way when you get out in the world of reality. Another problem that evolutionists have never explained. Somebody says, my teacher said evolution was a fact. I want to tell you one thing. Yeah, I know Huxley. I've read Huxley and Gaylord Simpson. I've read burned my eyeballs out. Reading statement by men like that. But I have under this rack statements by some of the most outstanding scientists living today, men of eminent degrees, that'll tell you at best it is a workable hypothesis. All right, something that's never been explained is in this scale right here that no life-bearing fossils have ever been found below the Cambrian layer. All right, now notice this. Life appears here in the Cambrian. All right, watch this. These layers and fossils are out of place. Something that's never been explained is that Cretaceous chalk, 120 million years, and Pleistocene silt right here, 120 million years apart, under London, England, they're mixed just like that. And no scientist on earth has ever explained it. They're 120 million years apart in London. They're mixed just like that. All right. Next, somebody says, how do they date those rocks? Not by their shape, not by their color, not by their appearance, not the color, shape, form, or appearance, and rocks can't talk. So how do they date the rocks? All right, we dig up a rock. That rock is tested. How do we know how old this rock is? By the fossils it contains. How do we know how old these fossils are? By the type of rocks they're found in. Now, if you didn't catch that, pray over it about 5 minutes. Maybe the Lord will reveal it to you. This young man and I make up a story. I say, I'll prove it to you, and you prove it to me. Okay. How do you know how old those rocks are? By the fossils they contain. How do you know how old those fossils are? By the rocks they contain. By the rocks they're found in. All right, that is circular reasoning. And I have right here, under this rack, the statement of some of the most brilliant men on earth that have acknowledged the circular reasoning. Have you ever seen people go like this? That means he thinks in a circle. If you want to know more about circular reasoning and logic-type compartments, read the works of Pavlov and Menninger and Jung and Nietzsche, if you want to waste a little time. All right, watch this. Layers and fossils out of place. Cretaceous chalk. All right. I was taught in school that there was a sea creature named a coelacanth. C-O-E-L-C-A-N-T-H. A coelacanth. That coelacanth was supposed to have become extinct way down here, millions of years ago. I was taught that that coelacanth was one of the proofs of the missing links of evolution. That the coelacanth, was one of those links that men have been looking for. But my friends, in 1938, a coelacanth was caught off the coast of Africa. There was absolutely no difference in the coelacanth caught in 1938 and the one in the fossil record that are supposed to be 30 million years old. 30 million years, no change. Next. In the last 36 years, 36 of those coelacanths have been caught. You know what they've been called? A living fossil. The last one was caught in 1972. It's in the museum up here at Vancouver, British Columbia. All right? A coelacanth, about 30 million years out of place. Archelons, way down here, have been found on the sea bottoms today. Over at Stuttgart, Germany, they found the skull of a modern human being living up here, down here in a coal vein formed in the Pennsylvanian Carboniferous period of the Earth, supposedly 270 million years ago. But here was the skull of a modern human being 270 million years out of place. It's on display there today. All right, I have a slide that I could show in this auditorium. I didn't know that we could darken like this. I have a slide that I could show of a tree in London, England, standing perfectly upright. Here it is, a fossilized tree with the nerve roots, the feeder roots, the tap roots. Here she is in a vein of coal. How did that tree endure all those years while that coal was rotting around it for ages and ages? I'll give you a better explanation in a minute. All right, chains, and handwork metal have been found in coal. What was man who didn't come along up here making chains? I'll show you pictures of this stuff. I've got it. What are chains made by man doing down here in coal, which was formed way down here? All right? Human footprints. Human footprints have been found in this Carboniferous formation down here in Kentucky and Pennsylvania. But modern humans didn't come until up here. All right? Down at Glen Rose, Texas, in the Paluxy Riverbed, the footprints of men and dinosaurs have been found together in the same rock level, even though dino is supposed to have died out 70 million years ago. Man came along up here. They're found in the same rock level. We have a movie that since 1973 has been shown over 6,000 times called Footprints in Stone. I can arrange for it to be shown here at your school. When these footprints were discovered, the atheists set up a howl. They said they were carved. Sections of those things were cut out and sent to the Smithsonian. If I were to take a hammer and make a hammer blow right there and then carve the hammer blow right beside it, they'd look alike, but there'd be a difference. The wood fibers would be compressed in the one I did that way, and they wouldn't be in the one I drew. Those footprints were taken to the Smithsonian, cut right in two. They were compressed. They were made by weight. Then, with movie cameras running, back here where the dirt had not been removed, they excavated it away, and they found that the tracks still continued. Next, those tracks of that man were large, indicating he is very tall. You know what the Bible says about the world before the flood? Genesis chapter 6, there were giants in those days. Next, we have found there in Glen Rose, Texas, other places on earth, the footprints of Brontosaurus and Tyrannosaurus right together, and those dinosaurs weren't supposed to have been here, but about they're all several million years apart. All right, now notice this. This pail has been shown over 6,000 times. There's tremendous dinosaur evidence on Earth. 1 million pounds of bones since 1909 have been taken from the Dinosaur National Monument. We find here types of dinosaurs that are buried together in dinosaur graveyards that were supposed to live on Earth millions of years apart in this scale. Next, I can show you pictures and slides where a prominent geologist, name furnished on request, at Brigham Young University in Utah, had a large rock. And he was chiseling this rock. And when he split this rock open, to his surprise, inside was the sandal print, I have it right here, of a human footprint wearing a sandal. In the heel and between the toes were trilobites. All right? That trilobite was supposed to have been way down here somewhere. long before man ever thought about wearing sandals. But there she is, brother, right between his toes and right under his heels. They were right there together. Human footprints, trilobites, found them together. The National Geographic Magazine, October 67, page 493, shows a dinosaur bird, 10 feet wingspan, weighing a half a ton, living in Madagascar 500 years ago. Those dinosaurs weren't as far back as people think they were. The Bible describes some things that would fit the description of a dinosaur. Look at Leviathan sometime in the book of Job. Those dinosaurs lived in the world before the flood. Some of them may have survived the flood. The Loch Ness Monster, which was, by the way, they got some photographs of that thing right close last year. The Loch Ness Monster has the appearance of maybe being a remnant of an amphibian dinosaur. In fact, there's a move on now in Scotland and the British Isles to declare that a protected area to keep the thing from getting killed. Somebody says, that's a myth. No, it isn't. There's been some pictures taken of him right closely. I don't have time to get into Bigfoot this morning. All right. We have here... All right, now notice this. The early dinosaurs were plant eaters. The later ones, we're told, are meat eaters. And another thing about the dinosaur, the more advanced they were, the fiercer they were. The Tyrannosaurus Rex, probably the meanest of all. The more advanced, the more fear, the more fierce. How's that for evolution improving things? More advanced they got, the more fierce they got. How about man? The more man gets advanced, the more it invents laser beams, atomic bombs, hydrogen bombs, and ways to kill other human beings. All right, that's the way she supposedly works in the dinosaurs. But there are places, I want to tell you kids right quickly how to get thrown out of a college science class real fast. You're shown the pictures here of some of the plant eaters that had all kinds of protection to protect themselves from the meat eaters. But a professor was teaching me one time how that the plant eaters were here first and the meat eaters came along later. And here the plant eaters are protected with all of this armor plate to protect them from the meat eaters. Well, why, if they were here on Earth millions of years apart? Some science books say they were on Earth millions of years apart, and others say they were right here together because the fossil graveyards have got the bones of the old Tyrannosaurus, Triceratops, and some of those boogers right together. Next. When we find fossils on Earth, you find graveyards. You don't find evidence of something dying out slowly. You find graveyards. In the Cumberland Cave in Maryland, there's fossil remains of creatures today that are found all over the Earth. Dinosaur bones, different types of bones, indicate a sudden, quick death. Something destroyed them in a catastrophe. Now then, we have the Cumberland Cave. All right, 750,000 square miles of silt, several thousand feet thick. We're talking about silt like you would find in an area over here that was, you know, formed by riverbeds. 3 miles high in the mountains of Tibet, you find 750,000 square miles of silt. How did it get up there? May I suggest that the world that then was being overflowed with water perished? All right. In the Grand Canyon, the Devonian, Silurian, and Ordovician ages are missing. Dr. Clifford Burdick, who's done more study on the Grand Canyon than any living man, was astounded to find that there's 50 million years missing in the Grand Canyon column. Next. The pollen of modern pine trees has been found in the Hakati Shale down here 600,000 years ago, about 600 million years ago, way down here. Pine shale of modern trees found down here millions of years out of place. I repeat, you can draw this thing orderly in a textbook. You can't prove it out there in the field of reality. The key to oil and coal is pressure, not age. Somebody says, how'd the oil form? How'd the coal form? All right, in the movements of the flood, I have statements right here by some of the leading men with the Bureau of Mines that say that the key was pressure. These tremendous amounts of vegetation were deposited in places, and tons of silt were laid on them in the Genesis flood. Men with the Bureau of Mines say it was possible. In 1970, a barrel of oil was made in 20 minutes from waste. Because of what? Age? No, pressure. I was taught that oil was about 80 million years old. Dr. Melvin Cook, again, one of the leading men in that field, says that the pressure of oil that is found under would indicate about 10,000 years old or less. Oil men could tell you that the leaves of modern trees, fossilized leaves of modern trees, have been drilled and come up out of oil drillings off of the Gulf Coast. I've got that in oil reviews and petroleum magazines. All right? A far better explanation to this column than what I've given you here is the flood. These layers were made in the original creation. In the flood, the type of fossils that are found down here in the Cambrian would have been those creatures that lived near the bottom of the sea when the fountains of the deep were broken up. I forgot to say a while ago in the flood, the Bible teaches three sources of water in the flood. The fountains of the deep were broken up. Psalms 104 will tell you that God raised the ocean floors, brought up the floors of the oceans. The fountains of the deep were opened up. The rain came from heaven, the atmosphere, and the windows of heaven were opened. The water came from the fountains of the deep, volcanic eruptions below. That vapor canopy out yonder collapsed, and it also rained from heaven. Three sources of water upon the earth. Now, in the flood, these lower sea creatures were deposited here. The more developed ones, and by the way, there would have been a mixture of salt and seawater in the flood. You see, all kinds of waters mixing together. Then you would have had your land animals crawling up higher, your more developed animals up here, man and the more intelligent animals up here. Dr. Henry Morris, in his book, The Genesis Flood, establishes that we can take the Genesis Flood and show how the flood could have accounted for a model like we have here. We come now to our last display right quickly. Somebody says, what about the cavemen? I don't know how much time I have left. All right, here's a list of the cavemen. All right, here's, this is not all of them. I know this is not all of them, but I only have 50 minutes. All right, here we have Rama Pithecus. Now, doesn't that just scare you to death? Pithecus means ape. Rama was the name of a Hindu god. God ape. He's found in India. All right, Rama Pithecus was one of Life magazine's fruits. Made from three teeth, 3 to 4 fragments of a jaw. Late evidence showed the teeth to be like modern chimpanzees in Ethiopia. Latest evidence, an ape. Now, atheists laugh at the idea that God in the Bible took a bone and made Eve. But they take a little tooth, or a little piece, and a lot of imagination, and a lot of plaster of Paris, and make themselves a man. If they can make a man out of a tooth, then God can make a woman out of a rib. Those drawings that you see in books are men's imaginations. I've got a book right here, Evolution, the Fossils Say No, written by Dr. Dwayne Gish, a man of eminent degrees. Right here, I have a picture of Australopithecus, right here. Australopithecus, this booger here. And right beside him is the skull of a modern chimpanzee, absolutely no difference. Over here, I've got pictures of how one scientist imagined that Zenzanthropus looked like down here. Here's what another one said he looked like. Absolutely no similarity. I mean, just throw the bones together and use your imagination. All right, next. One of Life magazine's fruits, made from 3 teeth, 3 to 4 fragments of a jaw, late evidence showed to be like a modern chimpanzee in Ethiopia. Latest evidence of ape. He was an ape. Australopithecus. Australopithecus means southern ape. Australopithecus, Zenzanthropus, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, all found by Leakey at the same level. All right, this made a big blow in the scientific world. Leakey's proven you're 1 3/4 million years old. But Leakey later changed his mind. You know why? Because down below this ape, underneath this ape, he found modern circular stone construction made by modern man, and he came out with a conclusion later. He said that Australopithecus was a short-legged, long-armed knuckle-walker. Well, you know, he looks like an ape, he acts like an ape, he smells like an ape. You know what the brilliant conclusion was? That he was an ape. Brilliant man, brilliant. All right? I told you a while ago, I talked to you just a minute about recapitulation evolution. Or reverse evolution. Listen to this. September 1976. The August issue of Acts and Facts concerns a report concerning Dr. Jacques Reborn, director of the Yerkes Regional Primate Research Center, who is regarded as the leading primatologist. That means an ape studier. Here's a man who's an evolutionist and a leading authority on apes. Now hear this. Born has suggested a reverse evolution by declaring that apes and monkeys are the evolutionary descendants of man. He adopted this theory, he says, because of Richard Leakey's report of finding fossils of man which predate, that is, they're older than the supposed ape-like ancestors. In spite of the fact that the theory of recapitulation has been largely discarded, Born claims that apes and monkeys recapitulate their origin and that an ape fetus in its early stages resembles a human fetus. All right? One of the proofs of evolution is that a human fetus goes through the so-called stages that tell the story of evolution, that an unborn human baby at certain times looks more like an ape than it does a human. But the other side of the coin is that an ape fetus goes through stages where it looks more like a human than it does an ape. All right, if the first thing proved that man came from monkey, then why shouldn't the second prove that the monkey came from man? All right, this leading professor has come out now with this theory that the monkeys descended from man. You know what I think caused it? Probably teaching these hippies 4 or 5 years. Change his mind. All right. Now then. All right. You haven't got any hippies in Mule Shoe. We don't have any hippies in Texas. You know better than that. All right. All right. All right. At the same level, found constructed church or stone habitations at a lower level, intelligent man already existed. Leakey tested findings with potassium argon, dated them 1.75 million years old, tested by carbon-14, dated 10,000 years old. Science is exact, man, exact. Robert Whitelaw says less than 7,000 years. All right, he was an ape. Hippocampus, Java man, listen carefully. Dr. Dubois only found a fragment of a jaw, part of a femur bone, and a tooth. Can I mooch about 3 minutes, principal? Can I? Is it possible? Can I mooch you? All right. Dr. Dubois on the found a fragment of the jaw. Trying to get a preacher to shut up is like trying to slip sunshine past a rooster. All right. He found a fragment of the jaw, part of a femur bone, and a tooth. The pieces were found far apart over a year's time. Found 2 modern human skulls at the same level, but locked them up and said nothing about them for 20 years. It was a human femur, ape skull, and teeth. Changed his mind later and says it was a gibbon. Said he was looking for proofs of evolution. A hoax. Hesperopithecus harrowcookii. Found in Nebraska, 1923-24. Used in Stokes' trial in 1925 to prove evolution. 1 million years ago. Complete skeleton found in 1926 came from an extinct pig. Widely acclaimed in magazines and Sunday supplements, yet a hoax. Hesperopithecus, I suggest Duracopithecus or Hampshirepithecus, a hoax. That whole thing was built up from one tooth. All right, next, Neanderthal. At the International Congress of Zoology in 1958, Dr. A.J. E. Cave proved that Neanderthal was a modern old man who suffered from rickets and arthritis. He buried his dead, raised flowers, had a language, wrote, had calculation, and a larger brain than the average modern man. Brain size proves nothing. The 2 largest skulls ever found on Earth were 2,800 cc's. One was the skull of an imbecile. The other was of a United States senator. Proves nothing. All right. I wear a 7.75 hat. Proves nothing. All right. Neanderthal facts are found today upon the Pacific Islanders and have a vitamin deficiency. Heidelberg, only 1 piece of a jawbone. Dr. Lull of Yale University says teeth less bestial, less like animal, than in some modern men, probably human. 0.5% genuine, 99.5% imagination and restoration. 1 little piece, 0.5%, build the rest up, use your imagination. No proof. Piltdown man, listen carefully. I've saved the best for last. Piltdown, acclaimed as the missing link, subject of over 500 scientific publications. Skull is of a modern man. Fluorine content of jawbone different. Fluorine and nitrogen test proved jawbone to be that of an ape. Jawbone stained with potassium bichromate and iron salts to make it look old. X-ray photos show file marks. I've got a slide. I can throw it on the wall. Sometime I come back, I'll bring them. You can see the file marks. All right. File marks to make it look old. X-ray photos show file marks to make ape teeth look like human teeth. Dr. J.S. Steiner, K.P. Oakley, and LeGros Clark published this in 1953 with the Department of Anatomy, University of Oxford, in the British Museum. A hoax. All right, I realize I haven't had the time this morning to talk about mutations, RNA, DNA, all of these alleged proofs of evolution. I haven't had the time to talk about it. And by the way, evolution, what do you mean, evolution? I still want to know, what do you mean by evolution? All I've been able to do this morning is scratch the surface. But any of you young people that are interested and you want to study and pursue this field, there's more material available than you can read from now on. Right here is one of the most outstanding books on the flood, Dr. Morris. All these books are written by PhDs. They're not written by preachers. They're not written by religious fanatics. This type of material is available. There's heavy textbooks, but this is written in language that most intelligent people can understand. These books are not too expensive. I'm not trying to sell them. But anybody here today that would like to know something about subscribing for the Bible Science Newsletter, which comes out monthly, and getting the quarterly, anybody wants to know anything about that, I'll be glad to give you the information to where you could receive it. You've been a real good group. And I sure thank you for your good attention. All I ask is this, and this is all I want, that in anything that comes up for thou, look at both sides of it. There's another side of this, which has been hidden, it's been suppressed, it's been fought, but it's there. The association started out with 350 top scientists. In a matter of time, it's 575. Men are being converted to this type of belief all the time. You know what God promised His Bible? He promised that toward the end we'd have more knowledge. Proverbs 4, verse 18. The path of the just is as the shining light that shineth more and more unto the perfect day. I thank you for your good attention. You've been real good. One of the best groups I ever talked to. And thank you, Principal, for not noticing the bell. May the good Lord bless you.